And it was an assurance from the state that if something went wrong because you hired this person with a criminal record, that you would be covered. You'd get a tax break. There'd be some liability issues, coverage.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University, right here in beautiful Pasadena, California. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. My guest today is Claire Osborne, a graduate student in our Integrative Social Work PhD program, and she's a licensed clinical social worker on top of all of that, and an accomplished electioneering professional. You'll get to hear all about it. Claire comes to our program with an incredibly inspiring story, one of trauma, trial, and a powerful second act, especially with her foray into politics. You won't want to miss this episode. All right, so let's get to it with Claire Osborne. Claire Osborne, thank you so much for being here today on Saybrook Insights. It's a pleasure to have you. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
Good, good. Before we got started today, I was, for the audience, I was just talking to Claire. She is from my neck of the woods in the great state of Ohio, the Northwest. What did you call it? The best part of Ohio? Is that right?
Northwest Ohio is the best Ohio, so.
That is the best Ohio for sure. And we're glad to have you virtually as part of the best part of California, which is in Southern California.
Yes.
Good to have you here today.
There we go.
So we are so happy to have you here today. You're a current student with us at Saybrook, pursuing your degree program. And you have a fascinating backstory that I'd really like to talk about that informs, I think, probably a lot of your current work. Can you give us some insights today into that story and really aspects that you only feel comfortable sharing? But I think for our audience, it'd be pretty inspiring to hear what you've experienced in your life so far.
Yes, definitely. My lived experience is something I talk openly, honestly, and vulnerably about because I think it is really impactful. We are often in rooms with very important people, but sometimes it can feel a little intimidating. So I remind myself that my lived experience is not one that often gets put in rooms with very important people. So it is important that I show up as I am. So I am a recovering heroin addict. I have been in recovery since 2015. So I'm about to celebrate again another anniversary in July. I'm also a formerly incarcerated individual. So really when I tell my story, I have like a 15-minute story, a half hour story, and I'll just touch on some of the key points of that story here. Growing up in Northwest Ohio, I was not a very mentally well young person. I struggled with thoughts of suicide and really self-harming behaviors while I was in middle school. At the time, my parents' health insurance didn't really allow for me to have more than 6 visits with a mental health provider. And so I kind of grew up without a sense of community, without treatment for my mental health conditions. And so when I graduated high school, I decided to go to nursing school. Nursing school is a very difficult program, especially when it's a 2-year program here in Ohio. I think we started with 140 students, and I think we only graduated 42 of those. So it really did not help my mental health to be going through that kind of a program. I joke with people today and tell them that it is, to this day, still the absolute hardest thing I've ever accomplished. Of all the things I have done in my life, nursing school has forever been the hardest. So at one point during nursing school, I started getting into alcohol and drugs more heavily. And that kind of continued on throughout my early adulthood until it all came to a head in 2013 when I lost a friend to suicide. And it really impacted me because that was a person I had grown up with. That was a person who we were both kind of in the throes of addiction with. And I was still working as a registered nurse at this time. And so when I came back from his funeral, that was when I lost kind of any sense of control that I had or thought that I had over my addiction and drug use. And So that's where my crimes came from. I was charged and convicted with theft of drugs because I was diverting medication from our Pyxis machine at work. I also got a trafficking charge along that time. It was probably about a year later. My judge, Judge Aubrey in Wyandotte County, gave me every opportunity to succeed, giving me treatment in lieu. When I failed that, she put me on house arrest. Once I failed her attempts too many times, she told me that I would not take her seriously unless she sent me to prison. And so she did. So I went to the Ohio Reformatory for Women here in Ohio. It's one of the oldest prisons here in Ohio. And I spent, altogether, I was gone for about a year. I was in county, and then I was in the prison, and then I was released to treatment in April of 2016. So it was during this time that I really got concerned about what my future would look like. I'd went from making really good money as a nurse to unsure of what my future was going to hold. And after treatment, I decided that I was going to go back to school for social work. This is kind of where the barriers come in and barrier conversations really start for me, because most colleges will ask you if you have been convicted of a felony on their college applications. And so I was lucky enough that I did not have to do that because I was privileged enough to have gone to the University of Findlay while I was still in high school. So they considered me just a transfer student. I did not have to refill out any kind of application. My social work instructors at that institution were some of the first people who supported me as a whole person, a person who has made a lot of mistakes and a person who has potential of good things. I also got my, just for everybody's information, I did get my record sealed last year. It's been 1 year. I went back in front of Judge Aubrey, and she was able to see all the things that I've accomplished since the last time she saw me in court. And so she sealed my record, so it no longer impacts my jobs or anything like that. I get to check no for that box moving forward.
That's incredible.
Yes, thank you.
Huge journey.
Yeah.
I have a family member who I won't name, but because I don't have their permission, but been through a similar set of circumstances. And it is not easy, as you rightly note, to resurface back into, you know, kind of the workaday world, right?
Yeah.
And as a formerly incarcerated individual. And it sounds like, as you mentioned, there are some barriers there. When you think about being formerly incarcerated and all the challenges that you have prior to with addiction and mental health and then working, you know, going to prison.
Yeah.
What were the barriers of being formerly incarcerated, going out, coming back out? You talked a little bit about the college process, you know, some of the privilege you have, but I'm sure there may have been other things that you experienced.
The first one, I was lucky enough to get a job about a week after at our local Walmart in my hometown, but it was a process. Because of my felony, the person who wanted to hire me really couldn't without going up their chain of command. They did have a pretty decent forgiveness policy, and it also included like letters from my probation officer. My probation officer had to send my employer my drug test results and all of these sort of things, which I don't think would have happened in a bigger city. I was in Upper Sandusky at the time, and there's 6,000 people who live there. So you get a little bit of flexibility when you know the community so well. But when I moved to Findlay for school, getting an apartment was one of the hardest tasks that I had to deal with. One person would rent to me, but I had to have 6 months of rent up front.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's a lot of money. That's a lot of money for anybody, let alone somebody moving and going to college. So I was again, very privileged and very lucky that we found a landlord who allowed my parents to co-sign. And because I had parents who were able and willing to co-sign, I was able to get an apartment. In social work school, Dr. Robin Watchers Powell and Dr. Goner had to put an immense amount of work just to find me field placements. Because of my felony, I could not work in many of the organizations that they had previously partnered with. In the state of Ohio, I could not work for anybody that accepted Medicaid or Medicare, anybody who worked with children, and those are all state laws. So even if the person wanted to, there was no flexibility in that. So my first internship that I did, I was able to get a peer recovery community organization who specifically hires people with lived experience like mine. And I eventually later worked for them. And then I was able to intern at our local homeless shelter that was a faith-based institution. And because it was faith-based, they did not have the same rules.
Interesting. So if you could... I have a suspicion we're going to get to this in just a few minutes. But if you were to advise the governor of the state, Governor DeWine, and others about how do you best support formerly incarcerated individuals to reacclimate to society, whether that's you've been in for a short term or a long term, and then you have all the trappings that come with all the type of charge, et cetera, the conviction. What would you recommend in terms of helping people reacclimate that would that could improve the lives of them and the state itself in terms of the economy and people, you know, feeling better about the work they do and feeling better about working with formerly incarcerated individuals?
Yeah. So one of the things, I think it was last year, so the Pell Grant is allowed to be used by people currently incarcerated again, which is something that they took out, I believe, in the 90s. And so that's going to be
big,
hugely impactful. It decreases recidivism. It's one of the most effective ways to reduce that. But when the person exits... In the state of Ohio, we have a thing called CQEs, which is a certification of qualified employment. And the goal of that was for people who couldn't get their records sealed or wasn't at a place to get their records sealed, they would be able to apply for that. And it was an assurance from the state that if something went wrong because you hired this person with a criminal record, that you would be covered. You'd get a tax break. There'd be some liability issues, coverage, et cetera. This particular program has been vastly confusing. People are not getting approved at any kind of a rate. The goal was for it to be very cheap, so they didn't fund any of it. And so you're not really having that actually benefit. So ensuring that people can get that right away, I think, would be really helpful, while also making sure that the collateral consequences that are built into our laws are least restrictive as possible. For me, my record got sealed last year. And because of that, I now, for example, I work as a therapist now. That was something I couldn't do a year ago. But it took 4 years because I had two felonies. It took 4 years of being off probation,
right,
before I could apply for that. So that is a bit of time for somebody, especially for low-income folks, to be able to navigate. I had a very supportive family and friends who were able to help me hold on that long, and I was given a really great job. So those kind of things, balancing out our opiate crisis and our overall substance use crisis that we're seeing, is not going to get better unless people can make a living, a comfortable living at that.
Oh, that's a really good point. And I think so often I was trying to remember, it's probably not even worth doing at this point, trying to remember. My age is starting to get ahead of me here. I was watching something on the telly about incarceration or post-incarceration and the primary issue, right, is the recidivism comes back due to homelessness, due to lack of employment and opportunity. Hunger is another one. Those are all interrelated. Lack of community supports. And so the head scratcher always to me has been we layer on top all these requirements on top of those who have served their time, right? So you should be done. And to your point, like you, then we're in probation for 4 years. Now, nothing wrong with that. You know, I suppose, but to your point, I thought you raised a really good point, like the least restrictive possible. Like the goal is to get you and others feeling confident to go back and work and learn and be positive contributing members of the city and state. I mean, is that a fair assessment and that we could do better in that space? Or I don't want to lead the witness here, but yeah.
No, yeah, definitely. It is something that we must do better. I tell people when I tell my recovery story, that the most important thing in my recovery has been being able to live my life on purpose with purpose.
Oh, that's great.
And without being able to have a purpose, I wouldn't be able to have the solid foundation of recovery that I have. And so everybody in our community deserves to feel like they belong in the community, that they belong to the community, and that they have a purpose in that community.
That's great. Well, lots more where that comes from in the future, for sure. I think we've got a proud to say that we have a number of formerly incarcerated individuals pursuing or having pursued their PhD.
Yes.
And super brilliant and doing great things. You're among them, and we should have you all on a future episode. I think that would be terrific. Yes. So, you mentioned that after some effort, you were able to work your way into social work as a licensed clinical social worker, got your degree at University of Findlay. Can you talk a bit more about you got into the program, you were out doing the work after you graduated. What were the passion points for you? Recovery, I know, is one of those areas. What are, you know, when you got into it, what really struck your soul as, this is for me, I'm in the right place or in the right space?
Yeah. So for me, I really, when I started my undergrad journey, I really thought I was going to be working with individuals, and my goal was to go back into the prisons as a counselor and be that person. And then as I kind of navigated that space and we took like a policy course, that really became it for me. This macro level social work. My master's program, I chose Baylor in Waco, Texas, because they had a community focused social work program. And so my last job before I worked as a therapist, I've only been doing that for maybe 3 months now. It's been just a short period.
You're brand new. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but before that, I did program management for a peer recovery community organization working on building those communities of recovery. So how do you build an initiative? How do you get people to support other people? How do you bring folks together to solve common issues? So for me, even now that I am providing individual therapy, I still have this very community-based approach. Where are you getting your support from? Who supports you? Who informs that support? Those kind of things, because I think we as individuals heal very collectively, or can heal very collectively. One of the most impactful things, a nifty fun fact, the inpatient rehab I went to has been shut down for insurance fraud because they were in a Scientology-based program. It was a whole thing. It would be a whole half hour just talking about that. It was a great time. But the program had what was considered it was a Native American 12-step. So it was from the basis of the Big Book 12-step AA programs, but with this approach for this specific population. I believe the publishers are from White Bison is the group. And when I went through that recovery booklet, and I've been through 12-step programs time and time again, the focus on that I wasn't just the only one sick. My family was sick and my community was sick. And so when I looked at like the education that I was being taught and how like systems theory, it was really easy to see how the community, the policies impacted me. I don't think it's any great surprise that the opiate epidemic really followed on the tails of that Great Recession that we had. So when I think about providing services to folks, I don't think about just the folk as the person. Who are they in their community? How is their community impacting them? How can that community help them or is hindering them?
That's really, really great. And I appreciate that community-based approach. It's very humanistic, by the way.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
Yep, very in journey with. And when you think about kind of in the early part of your career now, so you're 3 months in really practicing and you're excited, what do you see on the horizon for your own career currently? What would you like to be doing? And it's always kind of a tough question, but like, what do you see yourself doing in 3 to 4 years? And we'll get into the politics piece in a minute.
Yeah.
But like on the social work side, yeah.
I am a big believer in what was meant for me will reach me. This individual therapy. So in Ohio, our steps for, like, I am an LSW with my master's. After 2 years of doing clinical work, I will be able to get my license independent social work. So I'd be able to start my own practice out of my house if I wanted to. So I'm definitely doing that. This job allows me to have a lot of flexibility to work on my studies in school and build new learning. I don't think it's going to be more than the 2 years. I really want to get back into macro spaces after this, really be working on impacting policy, impacting community development, those kind of things. So
good, 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 good. So now you're in the Saybrook PhD in integrative social work. I mean,
yeah.
Dr. Nguyen, who is one of just the gems of our faculty, mentioned you, and I'm like, I've got to talk to her. I mean, you're here. Why Saybrook? And what are you finding about the program? What is augmenting your work as a licensed clinical social worker?
So I chose this program. I actually reached out to my undergrad professor, Dr. Goner, and I was like, it was actually the tail end of the campaign, and I was afraid I was going to get bored. So I went back to school, and I was like, I need a PhD program. I really want one. Help me find one. And so she gave me two options, and she's like, she didn't know anybody who has been through the program, right? It's a newer program for this one. But she had heard good things, and it seemed like something I would like. And as soon as I came to the website, I knew it was going to be it.
It's like, oh,
yeah. It's a, you know, like the Cinderella slipper moment. And I've really enjoyed the program. I've enjoyed the different perspectives of students. I am actually in a technology and social work course right now that has been absolutely a blast. I'm specifically doing my project on something that's very relevant to our community right now. So I'm getting a lot of use out of it, right? It's always nice when you can use those skills immediately. And so, yeah, that's really how I found here.
Very good. Well, we're glad to have you here. Now, I have to say, as an Ohio native and one who grew up not far from you, where you're currently living and working anyway, I couldn't be more pleased to hear about your foray into politics and big politics at that.
Yes.
First of all, what motivated you with is hand-to-hand combat-y as it can be, and ugly and sometimes terrible as politicians can get. You have this great positive vibe going on.
Yeah.
What motivated you to get into it? How did you sustain yourself through a campaign? So maybe fill us in on what got you in, what you were running for, and how you stuck with it.
So in 2020, I was really paying attention to the Democratic primary. Through that, my favorite candidate dropped out, and I was a little concerned about how I would sustain that energy. And I got asked by somebody in Wood County up in BG to start a young Democrat organization here. And it really aligned with my values already, right? We needed a place in Hancock County that young people could feel like they belonged, that sense of community. And so we started that organization, and that message of politics is messy, I wouldn't want to run because I wouldn't want the attacks, kept coming up when we were trying to get people to run. And I was always going to plan to be behind scenes. But I knew that if somebody with my lived experience can just jump out there and do it, knowing that the attack ads are just listed basically for them. They don't even have to deep dive into any kind of search for any hidden skeletons in my closet. They are just out there on the front porch for them.
Fair enough.
And so me and some friends from the Young Dems with some volunteers from Ohio Northern University in Ada, Ohio, we just decided to do it. And we had some trainings that were made available to us, and I really wanted to have honest and vulnerable conversations, right? I wanted to show people that you could run with the messiest of pasts and do it respectfully and gracefully and with a lot of empathy. So one of my taglines was that I'm permanently passionate. So everything I said I'm permanently passionate about this issue, which is all very true because I am a permanently passionate individual. And we won our primary. We ran on really just fixing our education in the state of Ohio, addressing substance use and those kind of issues, and public rail and public transportation, which probably seems a little out left field, but I think Ohio is perfectly suited to be a leader in public rail, and we are really missing out on that opportunity there.
Without a doubt.
We had debates with the candidate who I was running against. They were at times messy. There is an Ohio law that states that if you have certain felonies, you cannot hold public office unless you get your record expunged. That law was written in 2008. Since then, in 2016, we changed our expungement and record sealing laws. We no longer allow records expungement in the state of Ohio in that same capacity. And there was nothing against running, just holding. And so there was a whole big deal of where my opponent wanted me to be removed from the ballot because of my criminal record. I had just gotten the record sealed when they found out. When I got on their radar, the record was sealed. It was so much fun. And I don't think people realize that. Nobody assumes running for office is fun, but it was so much fun. When we talk about what sustained me is I'm not that old, I'm 32, but we would have these college kids who would wake up every Saturday after definitely being out all night Friday to go knock on doors and meet folks. And that was an incredibly humbling experience. I knocked on one door in Kenton, Ohio, and the woman was like, "Oh my gosh, my son has been talking about you. He is in recovery. And he and his friends just cannot stop talking about what you've been able to do." And so we didn't win in November, but we had an impact. I still get stopped when I'm getting coffee or things, asking if I'm going to run again, telling me how much it meant to them that I did run. The infrastructure that my campaign built has allowed us to mobilize for reproductive justice in the state of Ohio. We have a ballot initiative this year, and nobody thought Hancock County was going to be able to collect any signatures, let alone the required 5%. But we are one of the counties who will have 5% necessary to be on the ballot. And that is because of the work that we've been doing. And it's such a humbling experience. And we see a lot of negative things in the news. Often, I think people in rural conservative areas sometimes feel so alone and fearful. But when Georgia did what Georgia did with all of their amazing elections over the last couple of years, that didn't start that year. That started years before that moment. So I personally believe that we are building the momentum, the infrastructure, and the know-how that I would be shocked if within the next 10 years, Finley and Hancock County hasn't flipped blue. So, yeah, we're taking the rest of Northwest Ohio with us.
My Union Democratic family would probably be thrilled with that.
Yeah, Lima's got buses. Lima's got buses.
That's true.
For anybody who doesn't know, Lima has a bus system, a public transportation system, but Finley has more people and doesn't have one.
Wow. Finley. Come on, Finley. Get with it.
Yes, I know. We're going to get it done, though. I have faith.
I love it. No, that's great. That's good. I am so, I've got like 300 things I'd love to ask you and not enough time. But let's talk about the reproductive justice for a minute and the petition you filed. So, and since this is a passion point for you.
Yeah.
When you look at kind of where, I know the state, and I've only caught up, family has like been sending me like, this is happening here. And one of them is the August election around the constitutional amendment change process or amendment process. Does that have it? Will that have an effect from your perspective on achieving any, you know, sort of movement on the reproductive justice side?
Definitely. So the issue one in August is basically saying that moving forward, if we wanted to change Ohio's constitution, instead of having 50 plus one to win that election, you have to have 60%. And then you also have to collect more signatures from all 88 counties instead of 44, which it currently is.
Got it.
This would basically kill any future citizen-led movement to impact change in Ohio. Ohio is very gerrymandered, so we often have a misrepresentation in our state house. So these initiatives are the only way that Ohioans can make their voices heard. We have sports betting in Ohio now, and we got the casinos a couple years ago. Each of those things would have never happened under this new bill. So it is, August is the most important thing. Now that we've gathered our 5% of the signatures, we are pivoting. Saturdays are for the campaigns for every single weekend moving forward. So we're going to be out knocking doors, making sure people are showing up, understanding what it is on the ballot, and then encouraging them to vote no so that people's voice. It's a social work code of ethics for social justice. Our NASW here in Ohio has supported voting no on issue one and the reproductive rights ballot initiative for November. Which makes me just so proud of the profession that I've chosen. It is incredibly honoring to see your social work profession uphold the values that you yourself hold dear. So
that's great. Well, appreciate the pitch. No lazy, yeah, hazy days of summer for you all. No way. That's good. So one last question on the campaign piece, and again, I wish we had more time where we could dig into this even deeper, but when I'm out in Ohio next, I'm looking you up and I want to hear all about this.
Yeah,
definitely. Yeah, so your opposition candidate, who you can keep nameless or name however you want, but how did that feel? So you, especially,
his name is John Cross, Representative Cross.
Representative Cross. So he's your representative now. What was that like going through that and having that negative campaigning lobbed at you? And how did you receive that? What was your support infrastructure like? I mean, all sorts of questions that come to mind with that. Yeah.
So we knew ahead of time that this was going to come. We were prepared. I had specific roles put in place for my social media. I actually had somebody, who ran my social media. They were like a PR marketing student. And so they would let me know when it's time to stop reading comments on social media, which was exceptionally helpful. Our local radio contacted us the night before. We actually got to go on the radio. And that part was nice because he specifically even said, you know, doesn't this draw more attention to you? Is this actually doing you a favor? And because of the type of campaign I was running, with the passionate message, the positive language use, John Cross looked like a bully. And anybody who mattered in my life knew he was being a bully. And so that, I think, really sustained me. The people who mattered the most didn't feel that way. And people, I was working at a nonprofit at the time. So even people from our local Adamus board, our public health boards, like those individuals would tell me, like, I'm so sorry this is happening, but thank you for being this kind of a voice, right? Even if they didn't agree with all of my politics. One of the reporters told Cross, do you want to take this stance? Because what are you going to do when it's a Republican running for office who has been the same?
What was his response?
I don't know. It was mostly just the rules are the rules. You know, I'm sure if a Republican was running for office, all of the Republicans in office could change that rule before it even became a problem. So
right.
We contacted lawyers through this issue. I think that was the most frustrating part, is that we did have to spend campaign money reaching out to attorneys, which was just not a good use of funds. I would much rather have used it for lit to give to folks at the door. So, but
that's very helpful. Yeah. Yeah. It's very helpful to hear what that was like.
I think it was, looking back, like, there's not a single thing I regret about it. It was a wonderfully connective experience. The people who volunteered for my campaign absolutely made the campaign. One of them wasn't even 18. So it's a kid in high school at the local high school here in Findlay. It was in their government class. They had to do reports on politicians, and they did one on me. Yeah. And so, like, I was always into politics since I was a young kid. So being that young kid, which I talked about earlier, how sad and depressed I was, but who deeply cared about politics in eighth grade, to have somebody giving a report on me made it all worth it. It was all worth it.
That's huge. It's huge.
Yeah.
Yes. You've had such an impact, clearly.
Yeah.
And I have such respect for people who run across the aisle. I have colleagues and friends who've done it, and it's not easy. And everyone I know who's run are not bullies, and you're in that group of people that see it as an honor and a privilege and an opportunity to serve. And to get there, you don't have to denigrate your fellow citizens. You run on
yes.
ideas, and that's what you were trying to do. And I applaud you, and I hope you'll consider more opportunities for the future. I mean, I think that you took the step, and you're to be applauded for your courage. I don't have that courage. The only election I've been through is being elected to my role currently, and that was hard enough, and that was not ugly in that way. So, well, as we close up, I've got two takeaway questions for you. And these are quick takes. These are not like, you know, don't feel like you have to opine too long, because we like our audience to be able to take these away with them, the thoughts of Claire Osborne in a nutshell. So let's start with, what does it mean to be humanistic?
I think it means to care deeply about knowing your fellow human and knowing yourself.
That's very good. Short, concise, and spot on. Perfect. That's beautiful. If you were to give people three major takeaways of how they can improve their mental, physical health, or help change the world, you get to pick one of those or combine it. What would those three things be?
I would recommend that everybody get really comfortable in the gray. Be comfortable with being uncomfortable. There's a lot of just nuance in our society each day. And then the living your life on purpose with purpose. I think when you are showing up as your most authentic self, that is when you're going to truly feel the impact around you.
Do you have a third one you'd like to add, or are those two?
I don't think so. I think those two just crushed it. We are good.
I was going to say, that was like pretty amazing. So, well, fabulous. Thank you. Is there? Would you like to direct folks anywhere on the web where they can find you?
I am on social media. I can't remember any of my social media handles. I am on Twitter. Hold on. I can get this real quick.
All right.
I think it's Ohio. Yeah, it's at Ohio Claire.
Ohio Claire, at Ohio Claire, twitter.com, at Ohio Claire.
Yes.
Claire Osborne, it has been an honor, a privilege. I've learned so much from you in just this short amount of time. It is really special to have you on today. Thank you for all you're doing, for being at Saybrook and being an inspiration to me and so many others.
Thank you.
Claire, awesome, amazing interview. Thank you so much for sharing what you did. Remember Claire's takeaways for today. Get comfortable in the gray. It's a nuanced world out there that we live in, and getting comfortable in the gray is important. And living life on purpose, with purpose, goes right to the core of being present, being engaged, sticking with it. I love that. It's just perfect. If you want to see the YouTube version of this podcast, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave a 5-star rating and review. And subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Google, Stitcher, Pandora, Amazon, and many others. Remember to check our show notes for more information on today's guest, including links to her Twitter page and other websites. And for more about our university and the Integrative Social Work Program, go to www.saybrook.edu, click on Areas of Study at the top of the page, and locate the ISW or Integrative Social Work Program. Or simply Google Saybrook University Integrative Social Work. Thanks, everyone. Really good to be with all of you. We'll see you next time.